the end of the end of history and the first man is what we should have said. And wow. Would that first man have been Trump? I don't know. I don't think so.
No, I think he's a grave digger. He's not a,
but he's making lots of money. You know, digging, if you can't build those buildings upwards, dig those graves downwards. You know, you're going to build the biggest grave you've ever seen. Actually, that sounds really bad. I didn't.
Yeah. Hello, hello. It's late August. It's BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hoekele in São Paulo, Brazil. I'm with George Hoare in London. Hello.
Hey.
So this is going to be, this is our regular end of month episode where we, amongst other things, deal with your questions and comments from over the past month. This is being recorded a little bit in advance because for reasons of travel on both our parts, work, holidays, etc., we're taking a little break. There's going to be some, you'll have already seen that there was an unlocked episode earlier on this week from when you're hearing this, and there's going to be something else we're going to re-release next week, and then we're back to our usual programming, which I should actually give a shout out now to. So what we've got coming up in September, we're very happy to be bringing you Orlando Patterson on slavery and race and freedom and self-emancipation. Alex Gurevich has done a fantastic interview with someone who, if you're not familiar, is a leading scholar on the historical sociology of slavery. He's the author of a number of books. You might know Slavery and Social Death, the concept of social death. That's his. A number of novels and a career in politics as well. A fascinating biographical history, which is brought out in the interview, as well as these more kind of theoretical and conceptual matters and historical matters. So that's very exciting. Very excited for that to come out in September. We're continuing the Reading Club, the third episode in the block on the middle class, is continuing by looking at Göran Therborn, the Swedish sociologist, on the dreams and nightmares of the world's middle classes. We've also got Richard Williams telling us about expressways, and expressways that have stopped being urban wounds on the landscape and have become actual places. There's a bunch of examples of this we'll talk about in New York, London, Glasgow, São Paulo, Seoul, and many places beyond that. We're also going to be having an episode on state capitalism, which is kind of part of an ongoing discussion that we've been having, particularly this year, on the changing nature of capitalism, the rise of China, and so on. Ila Salami will tell us about that. Ryan Zickraff, who I should mention now, has joined us as a contributing editor to this podcast. We should maybe do this thing. Yeah. Woo. Yeah. So Ryan will be, he's going to be joining us much more regularly, but also he's going to be specifically on early on in the month details to be announced, but American politics and culture will be coming onto that in more detail in a bit. So all that to look forward to in June, and some very exciting stuff in October, but you'll have to wait until a month from now to find out what that is. So more specifically on to today's matters, we thought we would elaborate a little bit here to start, before we deal with your questions and comments from the past month, on this idea of decline or decay. This was already a question which we dealt with in episode 500, kind of a big anniversary episode, which we did also with Lee Jones and Alex Gurevich. And there we kind of toyed with different ideas of, you know, what exactly is decline? What kind of decline do you talk about? You know, is decline always about your civilization against someone else's, which is rising? Decline of the West, that's kind of typically how it's understood. Is decay something which is maybe the better term because it refers to institutions rather than a whole order? You know, there's lots of different ways to think about this, and there isn't really any fixed kind of way of talking about this stuff, is there?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about decay, decline, all this sort of thing, is everyone's talking about it. It seems to be increasingly inescapable. You, for example, reading the current issue of Tribune, the British socialist magazine, their kind of the theme is after decline. It's about, you know, are there ways we can, or places we can look for hope in an obviously collapsing Britain. My words, not theirs. And yeah, there's some really interesting stuff in there. Friend of the podcast, Dan Evans, has a piece on the decline of the local, or more just like just going litter picking where he lives in Wales, and just, you know, there's syringes and all kinds of just shit on the in the park. And it's like these things which seem to be more and more observable, particularly in perhaps Western Europe. Yeah, what do they actually all mean? And it's got a good quote on the back cover, which Alex, you can tell us where it's from. It's from Marx, though. In history, as in nature, decay is the laboratory of life, which I think is a very neat, very great quote, actually.
So I looked this up because I wasn't familiar with this quote, and I was like, maybe this is like in one of these letters that Marx has, you know, where you're like, I don't know, letter to Kugelman or something, and then looked it up. So apparently it's from the French version of Capital, and it was not reproduced in the German version, and as a consequence, probably not reproduced in the English version, which will have been translated from the German original. In English, as in nature, putrefaction is a laboratory of life. Obviously, putrefaction can be translated as decay, but yeah, apparently this is from the French edition of the first version of Capital. So there you go. But
podcasts are a bit like those kind of letters, right? These are kind of our letters to Kugelman. Right, where we say,
are you listening, Kugelman?
Yeah, I mean, if you are listening, Kugelman, why don't you give us a podcast back? I know we're going to talk about actual letters to the editor, but no, I guess the key thing here is always, or that I think the episode 500 clarified for me a little bit, is okay, you have all these different models. Analytically, how do they differ? That's not unimportant, but what's the political stakes of talking about decline or decay or something else?
Yeah,
and I think this is something which you've. Sorry, that was a bit of an artless segue, but you have something in American Affairs, Alex. Don't you?
Well, it became artless once you started being meta about it. Then
yeah, this is why you're the host, and I'm just some Kugelman character.
Hey, Kugelman. No, anyway, less about Kugelman, but actually one last nerdy thing, which I realize now because you brought to my attention this quote about putrefaction, decay being the laboratory of life, which is that Adorno has a reading of Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West, in which he kind of tries to reevaluate it and try to find the rational kernel in it. And I actually used a line from that in this thing I have out in American Affairs about techno-feudalism. Actually, long-time listeners of this podcast will already be privy to a lot of, the arguments, because there were things that were developed and explored in our reading club on techno-feudalism, which was done, I think, 2 years ago, as well as recent discussions where this has kind of come up. You know, all these ways of talking about crisis, about decay, about decadence, about the confusion, disturbance, dislocations of our times, you know, we're all kind of, in some ways, and also from very different philosophical, political, disciplinary perspectives, all kind of trying to talk about the end of history, you know, talk about the chaos of our times. How do you conceptualize that, right? Anyway, so Adorno, who might now, I think about it, be familiar with this quotation from Marx in the French edition of Capital, he says that in a brutal and oppressed life, decadence becomes the refuge of a potentially better life by renouncing its allegiance to this one and to its culture, its crudeness, and its sublimity, right? So you might find some seeds of the future in embracing decay, in understanding the fact that there's no saving this form of society. That might be hopeful.
Yeah, I am drawn to the idea that all ways to describe our current moment are symptomatic, except for the end of history. And so there's the actual description, and then it's like, oh, it's interesting you choose to talk about decay. This means that you are, I don't know. Well, but actually, a good example, I think, catastrophe. People who talk too much about catastrophe, I think it's a disavowal, and it is, I think, deeply ideological, because it puts forward an objective crisis. But I think our problems are all subjective at the moment. They're all it's not out there, it's in here.
That's undialectical. Cool. Undialectical as usual, George.
The call is coming from inside the house. as it always does.
I'm always skeptical of those arguments because it just means like, you know, if you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, be subjective,
yeah,
do politics, things yeah will be better. And it's like, okay, yeah, so easy. Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's not that easy, but it's not that hard. I was going to say, no, it's very hard. But anyway, I think also disruption is another good example
yeah
of a kind of ideological framing, which I think is quite not completely transparent, but you know, at its Silicon Valley edges, it's like, yeah, any change, any decline of the old institutions is actually liberating, is freeing. And this, of course, we've talked about this a number of times on the podcast, particularly probably with relation to the family and family abolition, as you see this kind of accelerationism as a kind of excuse for kind of, you know, decline and collapse and entropy.
Yeah. And
which,
I think
which is implausible, or I don't know. You pointed something
interesting, which is right. The Silicon Valley accelerationist, for lack of a better word, and I think, you know, Nick Land most expresses this in much crystallized form, but you know, you can trace that back down, you know, to maybe slightly less extreme versions of this of Peter Thiel, down to more banal cases of all the way down to kind of what's the enlightened altruism? Yeah, enlightened altruism and various kind of utilitarian ideas. But, you know, they all kind of, in a way, try to embrace rationalization and disruption at the same time as a positive. And a lot of other people from post-liberal, conservative, left-wing perspectives, various, you know, from across the spectrum, but all those who would be not identified with kind of centrist neoliberalism, etc., are themselves trying to go, well, actually, no, maybe this disruption isn't good. Although, you know, again, there's different emphases, right? There's different emphases.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of normative evaluation, as much as I was about to look down my nose, kind of either the conservative, everything's worse than it used to be, that kind of complaint, or the kind of everything's better than it used to be, look how free we are, as a, you know, both of, as being kind of one-sided. I guess I do... My instinct is that, you know, decay is bad. I don't like it when things don't work. It might be just my kind of
you're a narrow... spring guy, not an autumn guy.
No, I'm an autumn guy, actually. Interestingly,
that's a time of decay. Yeah,
yeah, true. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, you know, decay on trees and leaves is better than decay in institutions and society, in my opinion, at least.
True.
But I just might be this kind of narrow-minded Anglo who's like, wants things to work and, oh, I just want the trains to run on time and all that kind of stuff. But yeah.
back to more kind of more abstract theorizations of this, perhaps. But yeah, I think there, so as we said, we're all trying to grapple with the breakdown of something, right? And yeah, I suggest think about it like in four D's, right? Disruption, disturbance, decline, and decay. It's worth maybe just going through these briefly, because I think, you know, disruption is the Silicon Valley ideology, right? Very clearly, we've discussed this in the terms of the Californian ideology, and particularly as you take that forward to the contemporary age, you find that a lot of the ideals of that Silicon Valley actually turn into almost their opposite, right? And as it happens, you know, Cédric Durand's reading of techno-feudalism, his techno-feudal theory, which, as I've said before, it's by far the best of the lot of them. I still think it has very significant problems, but it's definitely if you want to read one book on techno-feudalism, definitely do that one. But he points out, you know, all this idea of like a new economic dynamism based on startups. Well, that's just actually resulted in a bunch of monopolies, right? Workplace autonomy and creativity, be able to express yourself at work, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, that's just led to an intensification of control at work. The culture of like openness and mobility, like the Google campus, you know, this little kind of utopia, quite dystopian utopia that they've built, actually leads into spatial polarization, right? Of like cities, rich urban cores, and a hinterland where actual real production happens. Goods are assembled, produced, sorted, distributed. Animals are reared and killed, and all the rest of it. You know, they rely on themselves, but you know that polarization is a major consequence of that culture of openness. The idea that there might be, you know, the Silicon Valley world, once Silicon Valley takes over, everyone will become, you know, rich as long as you can participate and work hard. And in fact, it's produced innovation without growth, right? Lots of new stuff, but it doesn't seem to really turn the wheels of production and wealth, really, of social wealth. And then finally, like, that this means the state would be obsolete. And actually, no, it's only proved the resilience of the role of the state which created the internet and various other things as well. You know, Mariana Mazzucato is obviously the reference here as regards the entrepreneurial state. But anyway, so these are all kind of really deeply contradictory elements of the Silicon Valley ideology as it's been put into practice. And it all looks a lot darker than the sunny version of it, which existed in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, no, that kind of techno-utopianism, as, yeah, we should direct listeners to our California Calibunga series, which has a lot of stuff about that and gets that. The kind of, you know, yeah, I mean, sunny literally in California, like, you know, the sun is out, you've got great wine, you've got weed, you can go to the beach and, you know, have a good time, and the yuppies and the hippies are kind of don't like each other, but they're moving things forward. And now it is much more, you know, we've said this many, many times, but a definite feeling of dread pervades, maybe doom, but at least dread.
But yeah, I mean, and you know, the Silicon Valley types are still, as particularly the intellectual, oligarch intellectuals, as Yevgeny Marazov calls them, like the kind of the, yeah, you know, your Peter Thiel being the exemplary figure in this. Though, you know, Musk as well. Musk has his own ideas. I mean, I like to mock him as a kind of an idiot. And indeed he may be, but certainly has his own ideas. To the extent that there's I think Quinn Slobodian's next book is on Musk ideology, Musk thought. So, you know, there's enough there to write a book at least about. Be actually intriguing to read that once it comes out. But, you know, all these people are trying to basically take disruption and all these kind of things which we identify as negative, as most people nowadays are kind of, most citizens in across the West are kind of going, well, these are all the bad things that are happening now. And they kind of go, yeah, but this, but it's good. And actually what we need to do is take it further. And again, Nick Land does that in the most extreme fashion, but it also is in a way useful for setting it out clearly.
I think you said earlier, Nick Land, the most crystallized, and that just made me think of like crystals of drugs. And
also,
I always get this kind of like very speedy ketamine vibe from Nick Land's work. But, you know, in some ways it's the most, I'm trying to think of a synonym for crystallized, but you know, it's the most invigorating.
Distilled, which is another drug, I guess.
Yeah.
The best one, the best drug. Anyway, disturbance would be the second D, right? And I think that just stands in general for kind of turbulence, the breakdown of the neoliberal order. And here, I think it becomes often a little bit more geopolitical, right? The rise of non-Western powers, or the rise of authoritarian populists, or the right, you know, in various different formulations. And a lot of that is advanced by effectively the neoliberal center, right? This is the concerns over disturbance are effectively Nobbs concerns. It's neoliberal order breakdown syndrome. It's the world is falling beyond our grasp. There are new powers challenging us. The unquestioned hegemony of American empire is falling apart, and with it, a lot of the kind of ideological features of it. And then it's like, well, now everything feels completely at sea. And you find this particularly in amongst U.S. Democrats, and then in Germany, where it's like a completely vassalized state to the U.S., and then the rug gets pulled out from under it, and they're like, shit, we now have to make decisions for ourselves now. What the fuck do we do? And I think, you know, you could even, and here I'm more sympathetic to the author I'm about to mention, but Adam Tooze's theorization, I guess, of polycrisis, you know, is a more much more sophisticated version of this. And I'm not saying it's just Nobbs, but it seems to me also, as we've discussed on this podcast before, exemplary of an intellectual failure of being able to really say what it is that's going on here, right? It's not a crisis of capitalism or a crisis of modernity or a crisis of industrial society, as you might have said in the past, or even, you know, fetishistically, it's all the cause of the Jews or whatever other scapegoat you might wish to choose. It's like, it's polycrisis. It's everything everywhere all at once, which I don't think helps us very much. And it's great. It sounds good when it comes out of the mouth of Tuz, who is abreast of so many different things going on, an extremely wide reader, and is able to kind of synthesize this in a slightly, you know, digestible format. But in anyone else's hands, it just becomes like, you know, the map matches the terrain. It's a one-to-one representation of reality, which doesn't help us at all because, you know, theory is meant to reduce the world in some sense.
The map is too big. I've always thought, you know, people always go on about this map and territory, this Borges. The map would be too big. I mean, this is the problem. If the map includes absolutely everything, just seems madness to me.
Exactly. So anyway, I think, you know, Polycrisis ultimately speaks to managers, right? Speaks to the managerial class because Polycrisis says all these things are happening all at once. And therefore, you know, there's no future point, a utopian point from which to criticize contemporary society. This is all the problem of capitalism. And if we have socialist revolution, things will be improved, right? It doesn't have that. It's a polycrisis, but stuck in an eternal present. So what's the best you can do? Try to effectively manage these compounding crises. And then I think that just plays into a kind of managerial ideology. So I think that's who Polycrisis is for. I can't get beyond that. You know, it's not a revolutionary doctrine. It's not even like really a genuinely reformist one because it isn't even necessarily proposed, oh, let's have
it's
a democratic revolution, right? To gain control, take back control or whatever. No, it doesn't even say that because ecological crises are beyond, everything's beyond. And so I don't know.
I think there is a note of that, isn't there? It's about the difficulty of control and management. And it's a kind of, I mean, when somebody think of the managers and all the things which they have to manage, must be difficult out there to, you know, crisis, that's hard to manage. Polycrisis, come on, give us a break, guys. Yeah, I don't find myself reaching for disruption or disturbance very often, though, in the way that I would talk about things. So I'm kind of, there's two D's down. What are the other two D's?
Yeah, more D's. It's like that gif of the girl being hit with all the Frankfurters all at once. Yeah, maybe we'll use that as a cover image, or maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe not.
Not a probe. So anyway, Decline and Decay. Now here I find them more difficult to disentangle. I think there's a tendency to see decline as something going down and something else rising. But decay also presupposes that, right? Decay is followed by birth, is followed by decay, the kind of organic cycle of things, which is a feature of thought back to the classics. So it's kind of, it almost sounds a bit, you know, it's banal effectively. So it's quite hard to disentangle. I know that Lee Jones proposed, no, we should think about decay because he's thinking about decay, particularly in terms of institutions, right? So it's a decay of economic growth, of economic vitality. It's the decay of representative political institutions, of democracy. And it's the decay in a more geopolitical or international relations sense of the institutions that arose after the end of the Second World War and particularly were dominant at the end of the Cold War. And it's the breakdown of those or the challenge of those, internal and external, that characterize our times. And I think that's useful because it analyzes those things in a concrete sense in the West. But I think we can probably go a little bit further in trying to kind of schematize the typologies of decline or decay, and here without any preference to one term or the other, because I think they're almost synonymous, and I'm not sure there's not much useful in kind of quibbling about which one you use. But I think that one can, and this is something that Alex Gurevich said in episode 500, but to elaborate a little bit more on it, I think you can talk about normative and descriptive decay. Does that make sense to you, George?
Yeah, very much so. Although it's difficult entirely to separate the normative and the descriptive in this case, as in many such cases. But I think there is a, you know, particularly conservative lament when it comes to decline, that you have a once great society, you have a normative image or normative past, or, you know, real or constructed, or a construction of what is partly real. And then it's a falling away from that greatness, usually due to some moral problem. And a descriptive account is obviously starts from a completely different place. And you can think of someone like Wolfgang Schrake, you would see, or perhaps the account given by Peter Mayer and used by many from his work. These are two examples of decay, of how institutions undermine themselves or come to through their internal dynamics. I think generally some external factors, but generally it's an internal process. They come to become contradictory and stop working one way or another.
And it can be, it's kind of new, it's descriptive because it's neutral. It could be empirical, but it can also be analytical, or it can be a structural account. But I think that is not so important when we think about descriptive versus normative. It's to say, look, this order as a whole, or this institution, or these sets of institutions are falling apart in some way, and something else might be rising, and you're just looking at them neutrally. And you might, to an extent, you can say, even Marx's account of capitalism's internal contradictions, say, well, there's a sense of it becoming, overripe and has to be overthrown through revolution. There's a descriptive a sense to that, whereas the normative one is really like a sense of loss, and often is about kind of questions of morality or of virtue, right? That our Western societies have become decadent, which is, decayed effectively, but they've become morally decadent. But I think there's also a normative sense in which things were better. We just say things were better before. And you might say, if you look back at our position now versus the 1990s or versus the 1970s, you might say, well, in certain respects, we're worse off now today, right? And so there's a normative, if you're being materialist about it, I don't think, and particularly materialism, not just which is about things, but in a much more live sense of materialism, the normative and the descriptive aren't easily disentangled. Or one shouldn't seek to disentangle them, because you can make a claim about, in relation to, for example, freedom. Were we more free before? Did we have the more conditions of collective autonomy, of democracy, which made us more free before than we are now? Yes, clearly. So I think there's a normative decline as much as there is as a descriptive one.
Yeah. So I guess kind of on the other side of all of this, so because it seems like if everyone is talking about disruption, disturbance, decay or decline, what is the kind of other side of it? Who are the people who are giving a kind of alternative account? And there's a good piece in the most recent New Left Review on basically comparing Trump's, what the Chinese call winism, his kind of, all about wins, 50 wins in 50 days, and kind of, his ebullience, put it that way, with Fukuyama's kind of Trumpism at the end of, although as we've talked about, and hopefully by this point, readers of the book or listeners to the podcast know that Fukuyama wasn't like, yay, liberal democracy is the only game in town, it's all done. He was like, yeah, this is going to be not great. Flabby, prosperous, self-satisfied, inward-looking, weak-willed states whose grandest project was nothing more heroic than the creation of the common market. So he wasn't like, oh, it was a kind of win, but you haven't played very well, and you're just like, oh yeah, this is, we don't have any more competition now, so we're ultimately going to get worse. Anyway, okay, yeah. So I think, so like, maybe this is part of Trump's appeal to a great extent. And this isn't actually what the piece in the New Left Review argues, but the kind of, the going against the contemporary pessimism and the like, the decline, and just the general kind of bad vibes. And here you have somebody who's winning,
It's,
you
could be a winner too. It's interesting because in part it's, I guess, countercultural, but in another sense it's entirely with the culture. So it's counterculture in the sense that you describe, that it's like against the pessimism, like, yeah, we're going to be winning. But on the other hand, it seems just a taking to a political level of existing entrepreneurial ideology, the ideology of success, that if you're rich, you've made it and you deserve it and you should just keep on winning. So there's a kind of, I think it kind of plays with both elements there. It tries to present something optimistic, even if it means going back to the past, right? Make America great again. Let's go back to the 1950s. But also an element of like, yeah, let's get those quick wins in there. If you hustle, you're gonna get your score. And so it's kind of, in that regard, not so countercultural.
Yeah, it does. make me think that, you know, the title of the book, The End of the History, The End of History and the Last Man, the end of history and the first man is what we should have, should have said. And wow. Would that first man have been Trump? I don't know. I don't think
so. No, I think he's a grave digger. He's not a,
but he's making lots of money, you know, digging. If you can't build those buildings upwards, dig those graves downwards, you know, we're going to build the biggest grave you've ever seen. Actually, that sounds really bad. I didn't.
Yeah. And people are doing that. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not to be joked about.
We don't endorse that on this podcast.
No, but to be more serious about it, I think there is also an element of, you know, describing who's winning, right? As George has put it, you know, of talking about decline as relative versus absolute or particular versus universal, right? So you might have a particular claim, like the West is degenerate, unlike the Islamic world, which is vigorous and committed to moral virtues, for example, or against China, which is economically dynamic and vital against our decadent, complacent Western societies, stuff like this. And a lot of kind of conservative declinists today have an element of this, right? And often, you know, there's the normative versions of it, and then you also have just the basic descriptive versions of it, right? Like the West is declining, China is rising, you know, there might be a systemic rebalancing, a shift to a bipolar world order, all these kind of notions. But then you can, I think the other kind of intersection there, right, is of the universal and the descriptive, and indeed maybe normative, right? Which is like maybe capitalism itself is in crisis, or maybe capitalism is unable to provide the sort of growth and dynamism and development for the whole world that it once promised to do, and never realized it, right? And so there's a question, or maybe it's simply with regard to the West, and it's not really, oh, China's going to rise and the West is going to be diminished, but just simply looking at the West as a kind of, I don't know, as a semi-coherent entity, and that it's in decline in descriptive and normative senses without any sense of something else rising. And I think this is important too, because we live in a world of total capitalism, right? There is no outside, there is no other. And so China rising and the US declining doesn't signify what it might have done once in the past, which was something of real consequence and meaning in terms of modes of kind of organizing human life. They don't differ that much, right? The West and China, and increasingly resemble one another. So the consequences of that shift within capitalism, because there is nothing outside capitalism, maybe is not so consequential as talking about the decline of the US and the rise of the Soviet Union, or even maybe the, you know, French Empire versus the British Empire. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I take the point about, you know, relative or absolute. I think the move to, you know, from a unipolar to a multipolar world is that under the disturbance heading in what you laid out?
I mean, it's part, yeah, because it's tectonic plates shifting. It causes turbulence. It causes, you know, the earth to shake. But that might, that's just a descriptive, yeah, that's just a descriptive sense, yeah. Right? It doesn't imply any normative evaluation of like, well, does this make things worse for people in some distinct way or with respect to a certain value that we may hold?
Well, then I think I'm, yeah, kind of more convinced than of all these terms, the one to use is decay. Like it's the one that points to the real problem that we have with the hollowing out of representative democracy, with the collapse of various sorts of institutions. And these are due to internal threats and problems, and not external. I think it's better to keep the normative side of things as clear as you can, which might not be fully clear, and so to avoid talking about decline. So I think I'm increasingly a decay guy, but the
decay of institutions you talk about there, decline of representative democracy, that is a normative that is a normative evaluation. I mean, it's descriptive and it's normative, right? It's like,
doesn't have to be normative.
It used to be better. Well, because you're making a claim that it used to be better before, right? That
not necessarily. You can say that higher voting, like if voter turnout decreases, then you have a decline in representativeness. That's not a normative claim as far as I
sure, know. Sure.
Anyway. So you can, anyway, yeah, we've talked about these things quite a lot. But yeah, it's just I guess I want to move it back to the political stakes. Like why does it matter which one of these we pick? I think
I think it does because it also, you know, it's about whether the thing that obtained previously is something that we should seek to revive. If we can go back, what does it mean to go back? If we don't want to go back, why not? Right? And what is like out there in the future for us? You know, is it techno-feudalism? Well, you know, I obviously absolutely don't think it is. But if it is techno-feudalism, maybe the response to that implies, you know, you need to do a bourgeois revolution in reverse or something to make sure that we go back to the good old capitalism rather than the bad new capitalism, something like that.
What we need to do, yeah, is to reestablish the aristocracy so that we can then have a right. another bourgeois revolution, a full one, and then we can have a proletarian revolution. And it's, you know, it's a complicated system. There's a few steps, but it will get there in the end.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to go backwards, take a step back, see the whole picture, and then you can move forward.
But yeah, no, but I think it's important to locate these in institutions relative to which values you're talking about decline. If it's, you're talking about in a normative sense, you know, what has been lost with this, if you're talking, you know, if you're talking about things anyway. So I think these are all, I think those are just useful in terms of laying out these kind of axes on which you can look at this, because no doubt this discussion isn't going away. In fact, you know, it's now of such popular consciousness that it imposes itself, right? This isn't like some theorist or other writing about a thing which some people might read the book. It's like, well, everybody kind of is pretty aware of this, particularly in the core countries, particularly. It's quite obvious and everybody's kind of talking about it. And in fact, when people go out of the way to deny it, they look especially ridiculous. As Lee pointed out in a recent episode about Keir Starmer being asked, is Britain broken? He said, no, of course not. Of course it isn't. And it just sounds ridiculous.
I think 60% of people who were polled thought it was, and that was about the same as France, and exceeded by Germany. So, you know, political class might be detached enough to not see it or think they can get away without saying it. But the people of Europe, I think they know what it is.
They just don't want to admit. You know, it's not like they don't believe. I think they just kind of go, well, we can't admit that because that would be to do us down, and we need to be upbeat and you know, think, show that everything is under control. Anyway. Speaking of everything under control, let's deal with your questions and comments from the past month. It's episode 502, Their Own Personal Jesus with Lamorna Ash. So someone called Alex, not me. I swear this isn't like some sock puppet, not least because if I had a sock puppet, I would not give it the same name as me, although that would be the best disguise.
Yeah, it's the last thing people would think.
So just to summarize, Alex basically says that there's, at least in Australia, a significant groundswell of kids turning into nature or conservation to find meaning. Perhaps it's to do with deep time, evolution, adaptation of living things, etc. And I just think, you know, I like hiking. I love nature. I love being out there. But I think we can't have any pretense. I don't, without any of the philosophical ecologist baggage, I don't think that's necessary. I think we can have it. I think, and in fact, I think particularly as, you know, as a modernist, as a Promethean, as a blah, 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 you have to put nature in its right place. And therefore you can have an appreciation for it, but understand it in its proper terms, you know, be awed by the sublimity of nature without being like, oh, well, this means that we have to bow ourselves in front of it and, you know, not seek to control it. No, I don't think that means that. In fact, we should seek to control it and to fence off areas of wild nature for our admiration and
so we can
enjoyment.
Go hiking. Yeah,
exactly. So this one caught me by surprise, but Jessica M. Hintermeister provided a surprisingly detailed theological rebuttal of Lamorna's interpretation of Jacob and the angel. You can read it for yourself. I'm not going to repeat it all here, not least because I don't understand it. That's not a slight on Jessica. It's on my own comprehension. But just to deal with Jessica's final paragraph, she says, This reinterpretation seems to project modern existential or psychoanalytic frameworks, where divine and human are equally uncertain of themselves, onto a theologically vertical narrative rooted in covenant hierarchy and blessing. While imaginative readings have their place in literature or mythopoeic reflection, they risk distorting the revealed structure of the biblical account when presented as if continuous with it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fair comment. I have to say, I was particularly in the book, this idea of Jacob and the angel kind of struggling and kind of coming to mutual recognition through uncertainty, through kind of fear and misrecognition that then kind of crosses over into recognition. You know, that's an appealing kind of, you know, but quite modern dialectical perhaps understanding of these things. But yeah, I guess I think Jessica is probably right. You know, that does inject, it does bend the stick quite far in the existential or perhaps psychoanalytic direction. And that's not, you know, maybe poetically it tells you something, but probably more if you don't believe in God than if you do. Mm. So it's a kind of religion or a Jacob and the angel for atheists, which, you know, I'm probably guilty of asking questions from that particular perspective. So can't fully capture some of these things.
Well, but I think that's why it's right. I think that existentialist or psychoanalytic approach to it is important in terms of authority relations, not about telling you what the Bible really says or what people who wrote the Bible actually thought, but about how one should think of authority relations. And it's important because you can be an atheist and still hold to quite hierarchical notions or, you know, ideas of authority, which are
very true, but that's
theological.
That's not what most people who read the Bible think. I would suggest it's not like, here is this great metaphor. It's not, you know, it's not Paradise Lost. It is actually the Old Testament, the New Testament. These are big deal things that people believe, and we shouldn't sort of say, oh, I like this metaphor. No, it's not the same sort of language. It's not the same sort of
argument
being put forward. Anyway, we should stay in our lane, but we have
many lanes, and we should stay within them.
We should stay within one of the lanes and not be veering across
lanes
too much. Or we should indicate before we change lanes.
Wrong metaphor. They're earthbound lanes, and we should not seek to go into the sky. Right, into these ethereal realms.
Unless it's on an expressway, which is a lane which is kind of floating above.
But it's still grounded. It's not floating.
It is.
Expressways don't float. That's not what they do.
Yeah, this is true.
We're going to talk to an architect. Speaking of an architect, the next question is from Pier Paolo Tamburelli, himself an architect. Need to touch base with Pier Paolo about some interesting stuff he sent through. More on that soon. But this is in reference to episode 503, Effervescent Decadence in the Third Modernity, which we did with Phil Cunliffe. This was recorded at the end of last month. Pier Paolo comments on the Trump-Stalin analogy, which is to say, this is Christopher Clark's, I thought, quite witty idea that Trump is like Stalin in relation to Lenin and neoliberalism, respectively, in that both are gravediggers of the neoliberal revolution. Trump is trying to do neoliberalism in one country and thereby undermining it, just as Stalin did socialism in one country, which is a contradiction in terms and therefore can't be done. So I thought that was quite good. But Pier Paolo says it's also just that both are defensive strategies by powers that believe they are overstretched. And there's a reason for the stability that existed from 1945 to 1991. There's never been a world power so defensive as the USSR, not even the Habsburgs. Even the Afghanistan war, they did to prevent Afghan communists from going crazy and ending up like Iran, which proves that they were right, by the way. The USSR was such a stabilizing power. I think that's true, mostly. Now, and indeed, particularly with regard to Western Europe, where Moscow was always saying pull back, not encouraging its allies in Western Europe to go any further. Roberta comments, please do an episode on bad historical analogies. We need it. Oh, I need it too, Roberta. We will do it. We will do it in due course. But I wanted to get that one before the end of the year. We should be able to get that one done. JK has a comment on, now this is very long, I'm not going to be able to do justice to it, so I'm not even going to try, but it basically concerns us and particularly Phil being dishonest about Russia in Phil's portrayal being a nation which doesn't desire expanding its imperial sphere of influence, that Russia is just a victim, etc., etc. And JK says that's bullshit. Says a lot more than just saying bullshit. But anyway, in response to that, I just want to actually quote Jeffrey Sachs, of all people, he of Shock Doctrine, not of Shock Doctrine, that'd be Naomi Klein, but of, of Shock Therapy.
I am shocked that you're quoting him. So let's hear the quote.
None other than Jeffrey Sachs writes in an article from this month on his own website, Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 is once again regarded in the West as proof of Russia's incorrigible westward imperialism. The favorite word of Western media, pundits, and propagandists is that Russia's invasion was quote-unquote unprovoked, and therefore is proof of Putin's implacable quest not only to reestablish the Russian Empire, but to move further westward, meaning that Europe should prepare for war with Russia. This is a preposterous big lie, but it is repeated so often by the mainstream media that it is widely believed in Europe. Indeed, Macron recently was saying this. It's like, I don't think they're going to come all the way to France, but Russia is definitely a threat to all of Europe. Jeffrey Sachs continues, the fact is that the Russian invasion in February 2022 was so thoroughly provoked by the West that one suspects it was indeed an American design to lure Russians into a war to defeat or weaken Russia. This is a credible claim, as a long streak of statements by numerous U.S. officials confirms. After the invasion, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin declared that Washington's aim was to, quote, see Russia weakened to the degree that it can't do the kinds of things that it has done in invading Ukraine. Ukraine can win if it has the right equipment and the right support, end quote. So, that isn't to say Russia doesn't bear responsibility. That'd be silly. But ultimately, it's a much weaker power. The West had a lot of room for maneuver and drew Russia into this scenario. So at the very least, we can agree that. Episode 504, Vietnam's Victory, America's War Through to Globalization, which was with Sean Fear. I learned a lot from this. This was great. I enjoyed doing this episode. And indeed, so did you, listener, I think, from what I gather. In response to that episode, there's an in-depth discussion between the aforementioned JK and Lee Jones on ASEAN, anti-communism, regional alliances, Vietnamese growth, etc. Check that out. I found that itself also quite illuminating. So thanks for that. Bunga's been juicing with Jason Miles. We're going to skip over for now. But I also, always great to talk to Jason. I hope you enjoyed that, listener, as well. And then to finish off our questions and comments here, we have episode 507, Put General Will in Charge, created the character of General Will, based on Garibaldi. He looks like a little bit of a Garibaldi on the cover image. I don't know. People maybe didn't like that. But anyway, this is Phil's book launch, effectively, on BungaCast of the national interest. So let me just go through three comments. Two are more substantial. The first one is Rab G saying, is polycrisis replacing omni-shambles? I was partial to the latter. Well, as we've already said, I've said everything I have to say on polycrisis on this very episode already.
Yeah.
So there you go. I should have moved that question up so I could have seemed like I was responding to Rab.
Yeah, this is just omni-shambolic organization.
Yes. We have, what's the Latin for, we're not going to do this now. Anyway. Speaking of Greek, Jonas Kiratsis. No, come on. It's a perfect segue again. I'm smashing it. Jonas Kiratsis says, while I'm sympathetic to the desire for democratic representation, and it's great to hear Phil again, I do feel that a lot of this is a response to the dominant rhetoric of the liberal Anglosphere, particularly in the UK. The right, including in America, has never stopped dressing up what they do as being in the national interest. Even in the globalist era, things were often explained in terms of, quote, we're doing this for America, end quote. Outside of the Anglosphere, that's still the dominant rhetorical mode, even under globalism. In Greece, a country that has fully lost its sovereignty and become a European colony, even this subjugation itself is discussed as being in the national interest. The reason that the majority of Greeks are currently afraid of exiting the EU isn't because of some commitment to globalism, which only exists in a handful of upper-class liberal elites, but because it would be against the national interest. That concept ultimately functions to obscure the harsh reality of class interests, giving people the impression that we share some kind of interest with the people who created this situation in the first place. Or, as Greek scumbag extraordinaire Theodoros Pangalos famously put it, "We ate it together. We ate it together." That is to say, we wasted the money together, collectively, as a nation. It's all our fault.
Mm. No, I think comparing like the UK and Greece and America in terms of discourses around the national interest is really interesting. I think the US probably is always an outlier. If you are the global hegemon, you are able to talk in a slightly different way about what is in America's interests, because you don't have to persuade any other countries, really. You can just say, this is the game that we're playing. This is the only game in town. The Greek story, like, am I surprised to hear that the reason that the majority of Greeks are currently afraid of exiting the EU is because of the idea of the national interest, if it's actually framed in that way? That's I guess it would be interesting to see the story of going into the EU and going into the euro specifically, and how that was kind of, was that justified in terms of the national interest or not? Because the, you know, Brexit puts the UK in a different position. We don't really, you know, the discourse necessarily is moving on from what's in Europe's interest to what's in the EU's interest, because we are now no longer aligned formally with the EU's interests. As you may have heard listening to this podcast or reading the news, Brexit did indeed happen. So a bit of a half-formed thought, but just interesting to hear from Jonas as always. But it does seem to me like Greece is a country where the idea of the national interest would be particularly complex, because there is a material interest in the short term against leaving the euro, but in the long term, the national interest has to be being outside of the EU and outside of the euro. I can't see. Well, I guess this is Phil's point, though. Having the debates in terms of the national interest clarifies things and is a step forward. But maybe that is the biggest step forward, precisely in the post-Brexit Britain, where we should be talking more about the national interest than we are, because we're no longer in the fetters of the EU. Mm. Anyway, it's a good comment, no, but as always. Thanks, Jonas.
No, yeah, no, and I agree with a lot of your comment, George, and I think it's true that there could be a lot of interesting kind of discourse analysis done on this. I mean, I would be interested to read it about how, as you say, the national interest was or was not a feature of debate, or the terms under which the debate was held in various countries with regard to entering the EU, potentially leaving the EU, etc. But I think this is, and I indicated this in questions to Phil in that episode, which is that I'm most skeptical of this national interest idea if it is a rhetorical device to which anyone can appeal to justify just about anything. Because when it is that, when it's a discursive bauble, then I find that it only works to say, hey, what about the national interest instead, if you live in a society which is so kind of infused by quote-unquote globalism, like Britain, that it actually seems that like a spiky idea, right? That it seems like something which is goes against what the great and the good think you should believe, right? But as we hear here, in Greece that isn't the case. In the US it isn't the case. In Brazil I don't think it would be the case. It's not like you're doing something edgy by saying the national interest. So that's where I find the argument a bit weaker. Or, you know, I find it strong if you're saying just with regard to the UK. But I in general, I'm against political arguments would say we should do such and such because it goes against what the elites are saying, just for the simple purpose of that. I think it needs to be justified in its own terms, not because, oh, it'll piss off people. I don't think that's a good basis for it. So where I do find Phil's argument more convincing, and we tried to bring this out in the episode, is that if you're talking about the national interest as an internal matter, as the general will and refounding the general will, then I find that much more appealing because it seems to represent at a higher level the will of all the people in the nation. I find that more convincing than just as a rhetorical device where it seems to be, could be just used for just about anything, as Jonas well exemplifies.
Yeah. I think in general, it's not a bad thing to be against the elites. Like, if you think that a certain group in society has interests which are not aligned to your own, and you think that they have a fairly developed sense
that presumes a lot. That presumes a lot, because you already said they don't have but if you're all in the same nation, maybe you do have the same interest. You know, there's an element of begging the question there.
I don't think it's begging the question. And I think, you know, Phil gave his account of this, and without, you know, wishing to ventriloquize him, the idea being that we do not have the circumstances for class politics straightforwardly. So the nation is a container that you need to develop first in order to move to class politics at a future date. And that's a big claim. And, you know, there were discussions about whether Phil is a still a Marxist, or is the last true Marxist. I can't remember which ones we had on.
Certainly not true.
Which ones on the episode. But, you know, like, to what extent is this position compatible with intention with some kind of Marxist positions or whatever? But yeah, I guess this is the, you know, this is the perhaps the situation that we find ourselves in today, is that we don't have the institutions for collective representation. And how do we build these? We build these politically. We build the containers first, and before filling them with the interests. I don't know. That's not a good way to put it. But it's, yeah, we talked about this in the episode, and I don't want to reconstruct Phil's position.
Okay, one final question, because we're ticking up towards the hour mark. John O'Rourdan, likewise, some questions, clarifications, criticisms of what was discussed in that episode. I love that this got to the heart of a lot of things, says John. I spent all day thinking about them. I basically agree with Phil, but when George asked how housing would be improved by the national interest, or framing things in terms of the national interest, Phil repeatedly admitted that the issue is a global phenomenon. It seems to me that many of the questions of the national interest are obviously international issues that seem completely insulated from national politics, regardless of what the nation does, although maybe an exception of the US. My point is similar to Alex's point about the international profitability crisis in the 1970s being resolved by globalization, which in turn undermines the capacity for national thinking. Phil's response seems to suggest that globalization was some kind of choice, rather than an abstract force on politics from without. At best, national thinking in the face of abstract issues like globalization would cause nations to operate as a sort of pressure or activist group against these impersonal forces, which might be the start of some greater democratic internationalist turn. And Phil's argument that national politics is a necessary condition for class politics anticipates this. But it doesn't really explain how such a problem, like housing, would be fixed. The politics of national interest might represent the beginning of being capable of recognizing how to fix things. Perhaps Trump's tariff and foreign policy are fumbling towards this sort of consciousness in a way you guys say. But I think if you're serious about this politically, I think it's quite important to clarify that this will not yield specific tangible results. Don't fall into the utilitarian trap that dominates all our political discourse. This was a serious flaw in the campaigning in favor of Brexit, which followed the same contours of argument. I'm not suggesting I've got a better idea than Phil. It's probably one of the best ones around, but it isn't really a solution to many issues facing us. And sometimes this argument comes across that way. It looks to me like Phil is advocating for the beginning of being able to think. I look forward to reading the book, concludes John. So firstly, on the last point, I entirely agree with John. And if too much is claimed, I'm not sure Phil's doing this, but if too much is claimed for the national interest, or that it will resolve all politics, I find that to be overclaiming, and thus undermining of the argument a little bit. I think it would be beneficial in cases to frame things in terms of the national interest, particularly in the definite sense of terms of reciting politics as a sovereign matter, and as talking about the contestation of the general will, perhaps as well. But it doesn't mean it will solve housing, right? And I don't think one should promise that, you know. So I think that would be something which, yeah, would seem to be overclaiming for it. And also, I think the flight from the nation, or as Lash called it, the revolt of the elites, also wasn't just a choice. It was something imposed by the profitability crisis of the 70s, which needed to be resolved in maybe I think things couldn't continue. They had to be resolved in some direction, right? And if they were, it was resolved by the capitalist class in the direction that that happened in the way that we went, or there could have been a revolutionary moment. But I think the continuation of the nationally bound politics, such as they were of the post-war era, couldn't have held anymore. So, you know, I think that one has to deal with that, that element of necessity, right? It's not just contingency, that there's an element of necessity there. So I think there are, I think there's a lot compelling about the argument, but I think we also have to kind of understand that the way things have turned out over the past 40 years, we're not just a kind of an accident or a bad move or something to be reversed. In fact, that's what a lot of what the left has done over the past 40 years has been like, oh, well, why do we have to do neoliberalism? Why can't we just not do that? And I don't think that's a convincing argument.
No, it's not. I think it's, you know, we've talked about this again a few times. I just keep coming back to this idea of class struggle without classes. Like, this is the situation that we're in, and it ultimately, I don't think it's an economic cause. I think it's a political one. I think it is about the defeat of the organized working class. That is the that is the political factor, maybe related to economic factors in ways that I don't fully understand. But that is ultimately what freed the capitalist class in all the different national contexts to escape from the demands, you know, put on them by the reality of class struggle, and to just do whatever they want, become holders of stock and citizens of the world, and free themselves from the vexatious inquisitions of representative politics at the national level. Anyway, I mean, it's a big question, right? Like, what started? I mean, we kind of circle back here a little bit. Like, we're talking about decline, decay, disturbance, disruption. Maybe put disturbance and disruption to one side, but decline or decay, what started it? Like, when did it start, and what started it? Is the current, like, you know, $64 billion question?
Write in, and you may win that $64,000 with your answer if it's good enough. I'm sure we can chip in, make sure that you get paid out for your brilliant political response. So we look forward to answering your questions next time, listener. Thank you for being with us. Cheers, George. This has been really useful, I think. Also, to think through a lot of things that we've been discussing over recent times. But that's it from us for now. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.